University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum features Dr. George E. Tinker, Assistant Professor of Cross-Cultural Ministries at Iliff School of Theology in Denver. His lecture, Indian Spirituality and the American University, was part of the annual Mattingly Symposium, which was sponsored by the university, March 23rd through 25th. Dr. Tinker earned a bachelor's degree from New Mexico Highlands University, a master's of divinity from Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary, and his Ph.D. from the Graduate Theological Union. He is an Osage Cherokee by heritage and an ordained Lutheran pastor. He is former director of the Bay Area Native American Ministry in Oakland, California, and president of the Native American Theological Association.
Dr. George Tinker brings a very rich background of experience, and he is certainly in a position to broaden our horizons. Dr. Tinker is Osage Cherokee by heritage. He holds degrees from New Mexico Highlands University, Lutheran Theological Seminary, the Graduate Theological Union, where he did his doctoral work. He is a former director of the Bay Area Native American Ministry in Oakland. He has served as president of the Native American Theological Association. He is now a member of the faculty of the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, where he teaches in the fields of New Testament studies and cross-cultural concerns. A recent article he has written is entitled Theological Education and Cross-Cultural Inclusiveness. He holds national responsibilities related to Native American ministries. He brings a national and a world perspective. He's just returned from Norway, where he was involved in a consultation sponsored by the World Council of Churches. His topic this morning is Indian Spirituality and the American University. Following his presentation, there will be a talkback session in the Callan Center to which you are all invited. I am pleased to present my good friend, Dr. George Tinker.
I think I've already said in Dr. Potthoff's presence a number of times how pleased I am to be here. I think I'd also have to say that I'm somewhat awed by the size of my audience this morning and want to thank all of you for being here and thank you for this opportunity to say something more to you about American Indians and American Indian culture, especially in the context of Indian spirituality and the American university system. I guess I would have to admit to being just a little bit nervous this morning. In Norway, speaking to some 50 theologians from around the world, scholars of renown, I had none of this nervousness. I was ready to do battle for the cause of not only Indian people, but indigenous people around the world. And I'm not sure why I'm nervous this morning, except that I know that I'm speaking for more than just Indian people. I'm also speaking, in a sense, for Dr. Potthoff, and the last thing I want to do is to let him down. My respect and reverence for the man that you have here on this campus now is extremely great, and I hope you appreciate him as much as we at Iliff School of Theology have learned to appreciate him. I want to start by clearing up a few things about my credentials, my bloodline, Indian heritage. It should be very obvious that I am what we call in the Indian community, mixed blood. For those of you who don't quite understand mixed blood, it works out this way. My father is Indian. My mother is Lutheran. The Osage tribe made its way in kind of a circuitous route from Missouri, finally to Oklahoma. You see, originally, we owned that piece of real estate that today is called Missouri, all of it, and a little bit more besides. And in an act of unprecedented generosity, we ceded it to the U.S. government so that they could open it up for Lutheran refugee resettlement. As I indicated, we didn't go directly to Oklahoma. We went to Oklahoma via a number of other pieces of real estate, starting out in Kansas. We traded Missouri for Kansas and enough food to get us through the winter. And that treaty that we signed, the English language of the treaty claimed that the treaty was good in perpetuum. That was the English language. The Indian language was as long as the water flows and the grass grows and the wind blows and the sun rises in the east. Osage historians have figured out that that means about 7 years. Because we signed seven of those treaties in 49 years, trading Kansas for a smaller piece of Kansas and a smaller piece of Kansas and a smaller piece of Kansas and a smaller, finally, piece of Oklahoma, which, by the way, had originally been ours, and we had to buy it back from the Cherokees in order to have a reservation. And today, Oklahoma is the center of the universe. Well, just north of Tulsa, in northeast Oklahoma, is the center of the universe. The Pawnees think it's across the river, but you know, we let them live with their misconceptions. I want to talk to you this morning about what may go on between white American culture and Indian culture in a university setting. I want to address the question of how much of what gets taught in a university, how much or how many of the methodologies that we, the critical methodologies that we have developed in all of our disciplines, which seem to be common sense at one level in the American university setting, or at least the received tradition of academic traditions, actually is a devastation for some people culturally, an imposition culturally on them that changes their common sense and their sense of what is right. If this is happening, then I would submit to you that that's devastating not only for, in my case, American Indian people, but it's also devastating for white America, because there is something of cultural value that gets lost, not just for Indians, but for everybody. And my basic presupposition is that Indian culture has tremendous gifts, spiritually, morally, aesthetically, to offer to white America, especially in the late 1980s, at this time of crisis in American cultural history. It's a matter of understanding that categories of knowledge that we have developed in the American Academy, or in the European American Academy, because it starts in Europe, to the extent to which those categories of knowledge are not simply universal categories of knowledge that work for everybody. Different people, different cultures, may have a different way of seeing the world, different way of explaining the origin of the world, different way of understanding how things are related around us. I'm told by my Eskimo, Inuit, and Yupik friends up in the North Country that in their languages they may have as many as 24 different words for snow. Those are different categories that they've devised to talk about the world in which they live. In Denver, we don't have 24, but we have more than one. But we have at Iliff School of Theology a PhD candidate from Kenya who assures me that they don't have a word for snow in his language. When I was in college myself, I minored in speech, could never tell it by the way I speak now. The professor in one of my courses, course was oratory, was explaining to us for about the fourth time how we could get by with great effect rhetorically by repeating something up to three times in a speech. But if we proceeded to repeat it a fourth time, psychological studies had proven that the results would not only be diminishing, but would be negative. At the time, I was dating a woman from Acoma Pueblo who was in the class with me. She leaned over to me and said, "Back home, if you don't say it a fourth time, people don't think you're serious." There's more than a humorous little anecdote there, because you see, the sacred number in all Indo-European language is the number 3, which accounts for many things. It accounts for why in all Indo-European cultures, including those on the Indian subcontinent of Asia, conceive of God as a trinity in threes. Why, when people speak English, or for that matter, German or Greek or a number of other Indo-European languages, when we link nouns or adjectives together with the conjunction and, we end up with a list of at most 3, and usually not more than that, unless we have an unending list of 12 or 13. And in the Indian world, the sacred number is always 4. We talk about the 4 directions of west, north, east, and south, and the power that comes to us spiritually from the Creator, from each of those 4 directions. There are other numbers in all of our cultures, of course, but the fundamental number for the Indian world is 4. I went to visit my son's teacher the day before yesterday. It was report card time, the end of the 3rd quarter. And at his school, they don't give you the report card until you conference with the teacher. She was explaining to me his strengths and his weaknesses. One of his weaknesses is in printing. And she was disturbed that he makes his O backwards, starting from the bottom this way, instead of starting from the top this way. And she wished I would teach him to go this way instead of this way. And I said to her, "I'm sorry, I can't do that. You want me to teach him to write counter-sunwise, and in my tribe we don't do that." I don't know where he learned that. He had half of his kindergarten out on the Rosebud Reservation, in an all-Indian school. Perhaps he learned it there. Perhaps he learned it because in our house, every time we go in a circle, it's sunwise and never counterclockwise. My first meeting at Iliff with the faculty, we sat down together in early September on the faculty retreat, Harvey, and we were sitting in a big room in a circle, and lo and behold, I sat down where I would be the last to speak, next to the convener. And suddenly he said, "Well, we're going to go around and hear from everybody." And here's my first meeting. He said, "We'll go this way and start with George." I thought, well, my goodness, I sat in the wrong place. I sure they would go the other way. These are all examples of categories of knowledge, structures of cognition, categories of existence. We all work with those categories of knowledge. Everything we do every day depends upon the category system that we have in our minds, whether it is finally articulated the way we do in a PhD dissertation, or whether it is simply an intuitive understanding of that category system. What I would like to raise with you this morning is the possibility that those categories from one culture, a culture that in fact has developed the fine academic institutions we call universities in North America, and this institution, in a naive sort of way, assume the universality of those categories, assume that common sense would indicate they are right, and then naively impose them on peoples who may have a natural category system that comes out of their cultural rootedness in another world, another existence. And in fact, when we impose a new category system on that person, something has to give. The old categories end up being destroyed in some way. There's another basic way of talking about this problem. There is a particular category that I call the metaphor of existence. That is the base metaphor out of which all of our other thinking seems to evolve. And for a long time, I thought that in the American, European, Anglo world, that basic metaphor of existence had gone unidentified, unarticulated by Western people. So instinctive was it. Every time I read something in philosophy or in theology or in any other field, I saw time and space linked together that way, as if they were equal coordinates, and that all of existence is played out equally in time and in space. Yet it's clear for American Indians that the Western world doesn't treat time and space equally, that one of them is an ordinate category and the other one is subordinate to it, and that the ordinate category in the Western world is time. Time, after all, is money. Space can be bought and sold, has been since the first invasion of the Americas by the Spanish and then the English. As Americans, European immigrants, swarmed across the North American continent, the vision of manifest destiny, of possessing the land. If it got too crowded in one place and you needed some elbow room, as Daniel Boone did, you moved further west and further west and further west, leaving the bones of your ancestors behind for someone else either to take care of or to forget. In the Indian world, the metaphor of existence would have to be space. Space becomes foundational for us to such an extent that time must be a function of space. And insofar as time is important for us, and it is important, it's not that Indians have no notion of time, but it's always a function of space. So that the holy places are define the limits, the parameters of the sacred in the Indian world. Sacred mountains like Bear Butte, Harney Peak, Blue Lake, and thousands of others are the places of primary spiritual importance for Indian people. There are no such places for churches in the Western world. Perhaps the Vatican. In the Missouri Synod, we always called St. Louis Vatican II. But think about where your churches are built. In this town, in the towns you come from, how sacred is the ground where those churches are built? If you outgrow those churches, think how easy it is to sell your church to Safeway and move across town, buy up a couple of corner filling stations, and build a new church in that place. In the Indian world, we don't move so easily. Places like Rainbow Bridge on the Navajo, places like the place of emergence for the Dakotas and Lakotas in South Dakota, for the Choctaws in Mississippi, even though they've been moved to Oklahoma, they still revere the place of emergence in Mississippi. In the Western world, the importance of time can be demonstrated in the academic works that have come out of our universities. Beginning with Augustine, you have a philosophical description of time in Book 11 of the Confessions. And from that time on, it doesn't happen overnight, by the way. I assume that there's a trajectory that begins that shift from spatial thinking to temporal thinking that begins, I would say, with Aristotle and especially the Hellenistic philosophies of Stoicism and the others. But from Augustine on, that shift is more and more decisive, so that by the time you get to the 18th and 19th centuries, you have people like Hegel devising a philosophy of history that is totally dependent on time. A notion, and some of you have learned this in your history courses here, a notion that every thesis results in an antithesis, that is, one situation gives rise to pressure from another situation, and the conflict between the two eventually results in a synthesis, a new situation, which becomes the new thesis, giving rise yet to another antithesis, and history goes on and on and on in that kind of a linear fashion. Well, it doesn't stop with Hegel. You have it picked up by Marx in his dialectical political philosophy. You have it picked up in Heidegger. Heidegger wrote a book called Being and Time, and no one in the West can conceive of a book Heidegger might have written called Being and Space. And finally results in Dr. Potoff's beloved Professor Whitehead and philosophies and theologies that are called process philosophies and process theologies. They, of course, reach a reductio ad absurdum in political notions of progress in America. And it's real reductio ad absurdum, I think, in the administration of Ronald Reagan, but I didn't come to give a political address. Indians, by the way, only do minimally better with a Democratic administration, and did better under Nixon than probably any other president in this century. it was Nixon who returned Blue Lake to the Taos Indians after a 64-year struggle, 64 years of denying government checks to pay for Blue Lake, which Teddy Roosevelt took away from them and converted into national forest. It finds its way into the sciences, in the biological theories of Charles Darwin, the origin of the species. Once again, we're talking about a process that is going on, a process called evolution. And in the modern scientific world, the theories of relativity of Albert Einstein, if I can caricaturize them for the purposes of making a point, Einstein reduces all space to a function of time. And if you can travel fast enough, you can catch up with yourself. I would like to read you a text. It's an Indian story. It's not a Nebraska story. I wouldn't dare do that with Nebraska Indians present. It's a story that has been long printed, so I feel some freedom to use it. It's also extant in so many different Eastern tribal traditions, including the Cherokee tradition, which is one of my tribal heritages. It's nevertheless a sacred story. It's a story about the beginning of things, in this case, the beginning of corn. It's a story about Corn Mother. Listen carefully and ask yourself, who is Corn Mother? And where is Corn Mother today? I thought it, by the way, appropriate to read this story in Nebraska. It is much more than an interesting and fanciful story of a simple people in need of simple explanations about the world. It is, in fact, a very complex story, opening the door a crack to the complexity and richness of Indian spiritual thinking, and not only spiritual thinking, but Indian life, because spirituality and life are not separated in the Indian world the way they are in America. People don't think of religion as being over here and work and recreation being over here, but everything is interrelated in the Indian world. I'm going to read the text, because if I told the story, I'd go past the 50 minutes that are allotted to me to speak. In fact, it might take 3 or 4 days to tell the story. Now the people, and you know it wouldn't take 3 days, it would take 4. Now the people increased. They became numerous. They lived by hunting. And the more people there were, the less game they found. They were hunting it out. And as the animals decreased, starvation came upon the people. And First Mother pitied them. I was talking with President White over breakfast this morning about Indian notions of ecology. We didn't call it that. But there certainly, you know, is a foundation in this story for understanding how we care for Mother Earth. How we care for the game, how we make sure that the game, our source of livelihood, the balance and harmony of all of creation is not disturbed. The little people came to First Mother and said, "We're hungry, feed us." She had nothing to give them and she wept. She told them, "Be patient, I will make some food. Then your little bellies will be full." But she kept weeping. Her husband asked, "How can I make you smile? How can I make you happy?" See, here's a husband really caring for his wife. And that's important for the rest of the story. "There's only one thing," she says, "that will stop my tears." "What is it?" asked her husband. "It is this," she said. "You must kill me." Well, no Indian can imagine having to kill one's spouse for any reason. "I could never do that," said the man. "You must," she said, "or I will go on grieving forever and ever." Well, the husband decided to take a journey. He traveled far off to the end of the earth. To the north he went to ask the great instructor, his uncle, Klaus Kerbe, what he should do. And Klaus Kerbe said, "You must do what she wants. You must kill her." And then the young man went back to his home, and it was his turn to cry. But First Mother said, "Tomorrow at high noon, you must do it. After you have killed me, let two of our sons take hold of my hair and drag my body over that empty patch of earth. Let them drag me back and forth, over every part of the patch until all my flesh has been torn from my body. Afterwards, take my bones and gather them up and bury them in the middle of this clearing, and then leave this place." See, this is a story of pain and suffering. And the pain and suffering of all the hungry people gets focused on this one woman who is in the process of giving her life as a vicarious sacrifice for her people. I think you can see it has certain Christological undertones. She smiled and said, "Wait 7 moons, then come back, and you will find my flesh there. Flesh given out of love, and it will nourish and strengthen you forever." So it was done. The husband slew his wife, and her sons, praying, dragged her body to and fro as she had commanded, until her flesh covered all the earth. Then they took up her bones and buried them in the middle of it. Weeping loudly, they went away. When the husband and his children and his children's children came back to that place after 7 moons had passed, they found the earth covered with tall, tasseled plants. The plant's fruit, corn, was first mother's flesh, given so that the people might live and flourish. They partook of first mother's flesh and found it sweet beyond words. Following her instructions, they did not eat all of it, but put many kernels back into the earth. In this way, her flesh and spirit renewed themselves every 7 months, generation after generation. Here we have the sacrifice of flesh that results in a communion of the flesh. As a Lutheran, I would, dare to speak the heresy that we are talking real presence here, that the corn that comes out of Mother Earth is First Mother, is Corn Mother, is Mother Earth. And as we partake, we are communing with Mother Earth and joining ourselves to that First Mother. And at the spot where they had burned First Mother's bones, there grew another plant, broad-leafed and fragrant. Was First Mother's breath, and they heard her spirit talking, "Burn this up and smoke it. It is sacred. It will clear your minds, help your prayers, and gladden your hearts." Of course, what grew in the middle was tobacco. Tobacco to be smoked, not in a habitual form the way people do today, chain smoking and lighting another one before the first one is burned up, but smoked in a sacred way, smoked when you pray, and understanding that the smoke is the breath of Mother Earth, the breath of Corn Mother. The Dakota and Lakota peoples call the smoke of the pipe Wokpe's breath. So that when they smoke the pipe and pray, the understanding is, first of all, that all of creation is in that pipe. All of the earth is there. All of the good things of the earth. And all of our problems are in that pipe as well. And as the breath of Wokpe comes up from the pipe, out of the stem, out of my mouth, I'm communing with Wakantaka, with the great mystery, or Wakonta, we would say among the Osages, the sacred mystery. You can see in this story, I think, the rootedness, the spiritual rootedness in the earth for Indian people. The spiritual understanding of our relatedness to Mother Earth. Almost all of our tribes have some notion of having emerged out of the earth. Even those of our tribes like the Osages who claim to have come from the stars, there's still some up there, you can see them at night. Even when we acknowledge that our origins are as Tsisho people, is the sky. Half of the Osages came out of the earth, the Shunkas. And through the mandated intermarriage between the two, the sky and the earth are integrally related in every Osage human being, whether I belong to the Tsisho division or the Hunka division. My heritage is both. So in this story, we're related through what we eat. It also says something about why it's so hard at one level to leave one piece of real estate and move to a new piece of real estate if you are an Indian community. It's very difficult to walk away from where your ancestors are buried, Because as I eat the corn that grows out of Mother Earth, as I commune with Mother Earth in that place, I am also continuing the existence of my ancestors. I am communing with my ancestors whose bodies, after all, have rotted in the earth, have fertilized Mother Earth again, and give rise to the new growth, whether it's the corn or whether it's the grass that feeds the deer and the buffalo, the squirrels and the rabbits. I am in communion with that place, with my ancestors, with the Creator, with Mother Earth, all of those things. And as I eat those things, I realize that they're relatives of mine. Even the corn is a relative. You see, we talk about the four sacred nations that make up the world. And once again, you see the number four. The four sacred nations are the two-leggeds. The four-leggeds to whom I'm related. So the buffaloes, the squirrels, they're my relations. And when I pray for those relatives. The third nation is the winged, the foremost of whom Elmer Blackbird, Mr. Blackbird said last night, is the eagle for all of our tribes. But even the sparrow is my relative. All the wingeds are related to me, and I remember them in my prayers. And the fourth category are the living, moving things. That is, all the plants. They are my relatives. All the rocks and trees, the streams and the fishes that swim in them, the lakes, they are all my relatives. The grass is a relative of mine. So that whenever, in traditional way, an Indian would go to cut down a tree for firewood, for any reason, to build, prayers are said because you are aware of your relatedness to that tree and the fact that that tree, every tree that is cut down, is sacrificing itself for my good and well-being, willingly, if I do it in the right way. Now, we're not talking clear-cutting a forest here. That only happens when Georgia Pacific goes to work or Boise Cascade. And there have been huge forests of redwoods clear cut in California, resulting in land erosion down into the rivers, the Trinity and Klamath rivers and the like, spoiling those rivers for salmon nesting. And up in the Northwest, then, they've blamed the Indians for overfishing the salmon, blaming the Indians because there are no salmon left in the rivers, when in fact, the rivers are no longer habitable for salmon. That relatedness to all things results in a notion of the wholeness and balance and harmony of all of creation. So that while four may be the sacred number, and you'll see quite often an Indian cross marking the four directions, it's more ancient than the Christian cross, and at least as complex in meaning as the Christian cross is. And I speak as a Christian, an ordained Lutheran minister. Quite often you'll see that symbolism of the four directions enclosed, circumscribed by a circle. And it does get drawn this way for my tribe. Curiously enough, there are tribes that also are a little confused on that. Al Ortiz's tribe goes the other way. And I've got to ask him why they do that. But that circle, no matter which way you go, marks the wholeness and balance of all of creation. When Black Elk stood on the top of that ridge, looking down into that ravine called Wounded Knee on December 29th, 1890. And when his heart cried out and tears came down his face, and he proclaimed that the sacred hoop had been broken, surely he meant the sacred hoop of the Oglala peoples that were being massacred in the ravine below him. The women, the old people, the children, the babies that were being bayoneted. The balance and harmony of creation was broken. The circle was broken for those people. But surely that's not all Black Elk meant. Spiritually, he's too deep and too rich to see that event affecting only Ogallalas. Surely he meant also to include the Bluecoats who were down there perpetrating that atrocity. Surely it was clear to him that the sacred hoop had been broken for white people as well as for the Oglala peoples. And not only broken for two-leggeds alone, but broken for the grass that was growing under the bodies that lay there. The circle, the sacred hoop, was broken for that little trickle of water that came down the ravine that now was saturated with blood. The sacred hoop was broken for all of creation. You see, it's such a polyvalent symbol for harmony and balance of all things. And to understand Indian relatedness, Indian rootedness in space, we have to understand that relatedness to all things. There is nothing that is not related to me. There is nothing that I can treat in such a way that it shows that I am alienated from that relative. And while I can be very forceful in pressing the Indian case, the Native American case with a white audience, there is no way in which I can stand opposed to my mother's people in an act of hatred. Yes, there have been wars between whites and Indians, but the attitude of Indians over against all people is such that whenever I'm in a ceremony, whenever I'm praying with Indian people, prayers are always said for white America and Black America and white people and Black people and yellow people all over the world, that they too may be healed, even as we pray that Indian people will be healed and health and wholeness will come back to Native America. Well, these things sometimes make it hard for Indian people to live in individual peace and harmony with themselves in a non-Indian environment. Make it difficult for us sometimes to be in university settings, to be professors at institutions like ILUF or Nebraska Wesleyan. Make it difficult for us as students, Indian students in a white university setting, knowing sometimes only at an intuitive level, not at an articulate reason level, knowing that I am giving up something important to me in order to gain something else, and never being quite sure whether the trade-off is in the final analysis healing for my people. See, in the last, the bottom line for me is not whether it's good for me, but whether it's good for my people. When I came to ILUF, the question for me was, is it good for Indian people for me to go to ILUF? Is it good for Osages? Or am I doing more good for my people where I am in California? And every Indian student in a white academic institution has to ask that question of her or himself. And my appeal to you, the only appeal that I can make, is that you pay attention to it. Understand that that struggle goes on in each of our hearts. Try to be sensitive to it. Try to understand it. And in fact, when you do that, you may find that there's a tremendous gift that comes back to you. A tremendous gift of Indians that comes from Indian value systems and Indian spirituality that can help strengthen your own understanding of spiritual rootedness, your own understanding of the world around you. It may affect your own health, well-being, and salvation. Thank you.
Today on University Forum, we've heard Dr. George E. Tinker, Assistant Professor of Cross-Cultural Ministries at Iliff School of Theology in Denver. He spoke on Indian Spirituality and the American University. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.